The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So we're going to do a sitting, but I'd like to ask you to do something during the sitting. Sit the way you normally would, meditate the way you normally would, but then keep an eye open and keep an inner eye open to notice every time your mind goes off in the direction of sensual desire. So it could be something as simple as, you know, wanting a smoother exhale because a more pleasant exhale, or you want a more comfortable, thinking about it would be nice to have a more comfortable cushion to sit on, or wishing that, you know, we put IMC in the countryside so we can hear, you know, birds rather than the cars. And wishing for more of your lunch, or wishing, you know, so, you know, anything at all that would qualify as a desire for sense pleasure. Just notice it. And if it doesn't make you too busy, too much, try to keep a running tab. You know, running count of how many things you can identify happening that more or less, and it can be very vague. It doesn't have to be exact. You don't have to, oh, is this a sensual desire? But just if it vaguely seems to fit the category of sensual desire, then give it a count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. maybe some of you'll get to one, some of you'll get to, I don't know what you'll get to. Maybe some of you'll have no desires at all sitting here. So let's sit. So, was anybody able to get any counts? Yes? How many?
22.
You probably had the same one. And someone else? Yeah?
I had three. I must be in a state of contentment.
Good, okay.
18.
Falling asleep. Okay, yeah, that's me too, a couple of times I nodded off.
25.
So about 1 a minute. Pardon? About 1 a minute. We sat for 25 minutes. Any higher number?
Numberless.
Numberless. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, numberless. Lost count. Was it interesting to those of you who were able to do that or did it? Was it interesting to run a count of how many sensual desires you had in the sitting? Yeah. What did they teach you, Mary?
They go away.
Well, that's interesting. The way that the mind can let go of some sense desires that come up, but some the mind is not inclined to let go of, and partly because they're strong, and partly because sometimes the mind will find various ways to justify that it's okay. And one of the more common ones, especially on retreat, is I deserve to have a break. You know, I've been doing this practice for a while. My knees have been hurting for a while. This is, you know, it's been hard. And I think that, you know, I just need a nice vacation. Let's have a nice sexual fantasy. And because that's, you know, more pleasant than knees. And or it might seem that it's just whatever the desire is, sensual desire, it's really important. Somehow it's, you know, it's, somehow there's a lot of value in it. And because of the great value that we invest in it, it seems like it's worthwhile considering and thinking about it, planning for it, or whatever. There's nothing inherently wrong with having desire for sense pleasure. And that was pointed out earlier, that there's both wholesome and unwholesome. And you could sit here and meditate and have completely innocent, or maybe not some, even better than innocent, some nice desires for sensual pleasure that maybe even helpful and healing in a variety of ways. And it's also possible to have a sensual desire which is unwholesome or unskillful, or if it followed through on it would cause harm to people. The idea in meditation in Buddhism is not to judge sensual desires, particularly, you know, that's not really the point here. But rather, what we're looking at is the consequence of the sensual desire in the context of meditation. And so it might seem like it's a judgment, like you shouldn't, that's bad, because you shouldn't do it, therefore it's bad. But it's more like we don't want to do that if we don't want to do Y if we're trying to do X. You know, if you want to go south, walk south, don't walk north. And so it's not meant to be dismissive or, you know, judgmental about it. It just meant that there's a better thing, that you're a particular thing we're trying to do at this particular time. Now, it is possible, and it is helpful to distinguish between healthy sense desires and unhealthy sense desires. Sometimes that distinction can help us get loosen up the grip that we have sometimes on the desire, the way we hold on to it. We can see, oh, this, if I continue this, it's going to have very deleterious effects. The consequences are not good. There's danger here. And that just in being aware of the danger is enough to, okay, I think I'll leave that alone. Sometimes. And then sometimes there's no danger involved at all. Just a fine thing to have. But in the context of meditation, it's just not useful then and there. What's interesting about meditation is that things which are, which in daily life would not be a big thing, become a big thing when the mind is relatively quiet. We talked about that last time. So you might desire, you know, maybe you desire, what?
A nap.
A nap. Well, that's nice. But say that you desire, you know, those yummy rice cakes. And so outside, you have a desire for a rice cake. You know, you can let go of that very easily, you know. Just there's all this stuff going on. You're driving your car, you have to take care of the traffic lights, and, you know, and it doesn't linger very long. It doesn't really interfere with what you're doing. But sit and meditate, and very quiet and very peaceful, and you're getting settled and concentrated, and then thoughts about rice cake, you know, they start, what flavor, and sesame, or is it? You know, and it comes up, and it kind of begins to agitate the mind, pulls the mind away from trying to stay present on the breath and stay there. And there's not a lot of reality interfering, like traffic lights or people talking to you or just stuff. So it's easy to kind of start following along those sensual desires. And something which is very mild in daily life and not a big deal becomes a big deal in meditation because the mind is so still. And so in that stillness, that calm, just a little bit can push you off center into and lose your focus. So again, it's not meant to be a judgment about these sensual desires. It's meant to look at the consequences of it and so that we can stay on track and do what we want. Sensual desire is like their number one thing, and some people it's not a big deal at all. Some people, it takes extreme forms, it becomes addiction. And addiction causes a lot of problems for society and for individuals. But there are some desires, sensual desires, which have very strong influence on people. And one of them is sexual desire. It's a very powerful force. And I think many people have been humbled by how powerful that force can be. And another one is, for some people, is a whole constellation of desires around food. And both food and sex can represent a lot of other things. It's part of the reason why it can be so powerful. It's not just sensual desire in and of itself, but sometimes they represent or are connected to other things. And I know that there are no shortage of people who have spent a lot of time on the cushion, somehow or other under the influence or being caught by sexual desire, or sexual fantasy, or sexual feelings, and as well as feelings and thoughts around food or alcohol or drugs, and kind of being pulled this way and that with it. And I feel like a little bit we'd be remiss not to really kind of spend a little bit of time on the details of some of the more powerful things that come up in meditation for people and people work with. And sometimes on retreat, especially, there are people who might spend hours struggling with some of these very powerful sensual desires that might come up, like sexual desire. And it's not necessarily easy. You know, sometimes it gets very unpleasant after 3-4 hours. What was initially very pleasant is like, give me a break. And it seems like you've lost control. There's something powerful going through you. And sometimes on retreat or in meditation, you can see the tremendous power and control that forces within us have. Attachments, desire, hormones, I don't know what it is always. You can see it more clearly in retreat and meditation because it doesn't get interrupted so easily. You know, you might go around your daily life and have very strong desire, but then so all this stuff happens. You know, someone calls you, you know, or you get a letter from the IRS, or you get, you have a, you back into some car, And so whatever you're fantasizing about just goes away very easily. So like, well, you know, you should forget about that. But on retreat, not much happens. Like that, it interrupts you. And so the forces are much more kind of, you know, flowing much more. And so I mean, some people have to grapple with this very, very strongly in order to come to terms with it, understand it, you know, work with it. So what I thought we would do for the next while is break into groups to discuss some of this stuff. And what I thought was we'd have three groups. One group of just the men, because there's about 8 or 9 men. It's a nice size for a group. And they can meet in the conference room in there. And then two groups for the women. And in here, in the meditation hall here, is the group of women who would like to discuss the role, the place, the relationship, what happens around sexual feelings, sexual desire, and sexual fantasy, and other things sexual, like that, in meditation itself, in the relationship with meditation. So how, what kind of impact does sexuality and all that have in meditation itself? The other group of women can meet out in the outer hall and then talk about food, alcohol, drugs, and other kind of very strong, you know, sensual desires that might come into play also in the context of meditation itself. So not just in daily life. This is not about daily life and how it works there, but how it plays out when you sit down to try to meditate. Does that make sense? Now, I think there'll be some large groups if they divide up evenly, the women. So if that's the case, not everyone has to speak. And like if you're interested in the sexual group, some people whose sexuality is a very private thing and just naturally private. There's nothing wrong with that. So you don't want to talk about it, but you'd like to you'd like to hear. You know, because it's important for you, but you just want to be able to. It's okay not to speak, any of these groups. I suppose the default, if no one speaks, is just meditate, and or change the topic. You know, is this acceptable?
Can I eavesdrop on the men's group?
No, the men are going to get secret instructions. So I'm not going to. I can't do this in public. So, when the men... What?
We'll have to call
it
Iron Gill.
Iron Gill? So when the men go in the conference room, I'll come along and give you your instruction there.
But can we hear
it? We need an instruction.
I just gave you instruction.
Yeah, you just got your public instructions.
Oh, let me do it again. So there's two groups. In here, two women divide in on their own. Yeah. Oh, no. No, don't. You're not getting the short end of this deal. Don't worry. Don't worry. And it's not really a secret. But there's a small group. I can't divide the men into two groups because it's so small. So we're going to sort out that one in there. You know what we're going to do. So don't worry about it. It's nothing special or secret or, you know, it's just, you're not missing out. So does it feel like it's doable?
Sure.
Seems doable? So men can go in the conference room. There's more chairs in the closet there you can pull out. The exploration of sexuality and meditation in here. Make a circle here. And other women can go in the outer hall and make a circle out there. And you'll have about, probably have about 25, flip a coin or go to the group that's smallest. If it's hard to decide for the women, then stay in the room here. If it's hard for you to decide which group to go to, stay in this group in here. So just for the women know, I asked the men to talk about sexuality So the in meditation, whatever role or relationship or influence sexuality has in meditation, sexual fantasy, sexual desire, sexual, feelings. So I didn't go to any of the groups. I didn't go for the men's group. I thought just stay out. Were you able to keep the focus of the conversation on meditation? Some people did. Some people didn't.
At least retreats.
The women did.
We did. Yeah, and
the other
group was
so-so. The other group.
They went further afield.
Some parts.
Yeah. And anything, I wasn't at any of the groups. Anything that anybody wanted to say or share that seems appropriate in the bigger group here about what that exploration was like. Probably shouldn't be any comments about the group discussion, but about your own experience in it and your own reflections, or
I just started it saying, "Well, it's not really an issue for me in meditation." But the more there was discussion going around, the more I became aware of how much it is an issue for me. So it was revealing.
Great, thank you. Use the mic. Some people can't hear unless we have that.
I have a question. I hear this meditation teacher Ajahn Brahm, and he always said that jhana is better than sex. And I just wondering if you can, explain this or teach me about this, or how can you compare with sex and jhana? That sort of question,
Well, it's a good question. How can you it's a good question. I think it's a fair question. How can you compare apples and oranges? How can you compare sex and jhanic experience? But it's fairly common, not common, but it's common enough for people who have strong jhanic experience to make that comparison, because the level of pleasure and rapture that comes with strong meditative experience is generally much stronger than orgasm, can be stronger than orgasm. So not just simply the ordinary pleasures of sex, but the pleasures of orgasm itself. It's because it can be very, very intense with strong jhana. And because it's more intense, and also it tends to last longer than orgasm. And generally it comes as much more satisfying. It's a much deeper level of satisfaction that comes with that kind of pleasure that can come out of that deep meditative state. So some people prefer it. But you don't have to compare them, and you don't have to prove one or the other, each in their own time and place.
That's really motivated.
Anybody else? Yeah.
From someone who came when I first started coming to any of these practices, and then you said we were going to speak to each other, and that was not why I was here, and I had fear and real aversion to any dialogue and discussion. The comfort that I feel in talking on these kind of groups, having a group and the kind of discussion we have, is just so, I'm just so grateful for having that, of having the Sangha to sit with. It's just so great, and there's just, now I look forward to, you say there's going to be dialogue instead of going, oh, God. Can I leave yet? Can my pager go off? So thank you for
great.
Everybody.
I don't know. I wasn't, listening in to the conversations, but I had to bed. But I had the strong sense that I was leaving you too short a time to have your conversation, that this was a pretty unusual group of a topic and group to kind of explore this topic. The groups were fairly large, and it might have been valuable to have had much longer time to have this kind of discussion. But it's kind of the nature of this kind of Dharma practice day. We don't have that much open time, so I don't know what the actual experience was, but that's how I kind of interpreted it. Anything else?
Or perhaps not bifurcated.
Yeah. Yes, maybe there's no need to break up the two different groups. It could have just stayed in one. But part of the reason I did it, to be honest, I mean, I don't know if you need to know, but is I asked my wife what she thought about doing just the groups on sexuality. And she felt fairly, she's not prudish, but she felt fairly strongly that this is a very private matter. And that and there should be some, you know, it's kind of awkward to have someone go into a group like this if they don't want to be part of it. And so, and also some people, it's not so relevant as it is for other people, and a variety of different things. And so, so I thought it was actually better, more respectful of all of you. It was actually Inez's idea, if I may say it, to have two different groups, so that it gives some choice and take off the pressure for people whom it was inappropriate to go to one of the groups. So that was the idea. I didn't want to force people to be part of a discussion around sex. They didn't want to.
But that's a quite interesting subject. I mean, especially we're talking about retreat.
Yes.
Related to meditation.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting subject. We did share a lot, and quite comfortable.
Great, that's I'm very happy to hear. And some of you might also continue these conversations outside of here. Some of you might invite someone for tea or for a walk and say, you know, that we started a conversation on this topic and maybe we can have continue the discussion. Okay. So is that enough for this section? Feel complete enough? In terms of the sexuality part, it is a huge part of human experience and humans, who people are. And it's often not talked about much in Buddhism and Buddhist practice place. Sometimes people come in interviews and talk to the teacher about it if it's an issue. But, you know, otherwise you wouldn't hear about it on Dharma talks too much. You might hear about Vipassana romances. But it's maybe a little bit different. And it's nice at least to name and put out there the fact that for some people this is a very important part of their experience and part of what they're not only their experience but what they're working with and trying to resolve and work through in order to be able to meditate well. So we've named it, and hopefully that's helpful for you. So let's take 15 minutes and then we'll come back for our last half hour.